Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today, as usual. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Elizabeth Currid Halkett, author of Starstruck, an analysis of celebrity and its modern form. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Joshua Holland, author of The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy. You do wonder how he kept it to 15. Before all that, some words in the news. First, the Federal Reserve released its quarterly flow of funds accounts on Friday, covering the third quarter of this year. The flow of funds are to the financial sector, what the national income accounts, GDP and such, are to the so-called real sector. The national income accounts measure the production of and demand for goods and services, and incomes earned in the process of that production. But they have nothing to say about finance, borrowing and lending, assets and debts. That's what the flow of funds accounts do. I've only gotten a chance for a quick look at the latest flow of funds numbers, but here are some highlights. I might have some more to say on this next week. The major point is this. For the last couple of years, the U.S. economy has been going through a slow process of deleveraging, borrowing less and saving more. That process mostly continued in the third quarter, which runs from July through September, with the exception, of course, of the federal government, which continues to borrow heavily. Households continued to rein in their borrowing, especially mortgage borrowing. Their use of credit cards slowed, but not as much as it had in earlier quarters. And households also expanded their savings, though also not quite as much as in 2008 and early 2009. Financial firms, who are intermediaries, meaning they borrow from one set of actors to lend to another set of actors, and pocketing a rather generous share of that flow, continued to shrink their borrowing and lending. Non-financial firms remained fairly prudent in their borrowing. Banks, though, which had double-locked their vaults during the financial crisis, have been easing up some. But this restriction of both borrowing and lending, outside of Washington, that is a major drag on the real economy. Although it's easing up, it's likely to stay this way for some time to come. What a deal between Obama and the Republican congressional leadership on that fiscal package. There are some things in it that aren't worthless. The overall effect will be to stimulate an economy badly in need of stimulus. Economists at Goldman Sachs, a firm maybe a vampire squid across the face of humanity, but its economists do some good work, estimate that it will add a half to a full percentage point to GDP growth in 2011 and knock about a quarter to half a point off the unemployment rate. That's not nothing, but it's not earth-shattering either. But consider that the U.S. will be the only major country in the world not tightening fiscal policy next year, and you might be moved to thank God for little things. And a not-so-little thing. The package would, if approved, renew the funding for extended unemployment benefits through the entire year, 2011. Normally, unemployment benefits are available for only 26 weeks, a disgracefully short period. During recessions, Congress typically extends that time limit. An extension of 99 weeks expired the other week, and if not renewed, the expiration would knock about 500,000 people a week off the benefit rolls. Restoring benefits would make life a lot more bearable at a time when long-term unemployment is at record levels, and would also provide a kick to consumer demand at a time when income growth at all levels below the stratospheric has been very weak. The 2-point cut in the employee contribution to Social Security would also provide a minor but not trivial boost to incomes. Some liberals are denouncing this move as part of a complex plot to destroy Social Security, but I doubt that. It helps people in the middle and lower ranks of the wage distribution a lot more than those in the upper, and it's temporary enough not to blow a hole in Social Security's finances. The fight over Social Security is going to be gigantic in the coming months, but I see this as a separate issue. The extension of Bush's income tax cuts will also help people in the middle. The working poor now pay little or no income tax, so that part of the package means little to them. Of course, the extension of cuts at the high end is an outrage. Ditto the major giveaway on the estate tax. Pollsters report that even the Republican base isn't all that committed to the high-end income tax cuts, although the estate tax cuts are mysteriously popular, since they apply only to a small percentage of the population. But the Republican leadership is passionate in its devotion to making the rich richer, and they made it clear that nothing at all would get through the Senate unless they got their way on this. Some liberals and Democrats have been doing an amazing imitation of deficit hawks, complaining that this package is fiscally irresponsible, not just in its giveaway to the rich, but to the extent that it adds to the deficit. Rachel Maddow featured a long interview with the former IMF economist Simon Johnson the other night. Johnson does have some interesting things to say, but he is a former IMF economist whose mind is never far from austerity. As I've said here many times, we do need to get our fiscal house in order eventually, but that's a task for several years ahead. Now the most urgent task is stimulating the economy back to health. As I said earlier, what we're going through now is a classic deleveraging, a process of undoing a debt binge that means borrowing less and saving more over a long period of time. While this is underway, it's absolutely essential that the government offset the contractionary effects of that rational private prudence by borrowing and spending. Otherwise, it would be the 1930s all over again. Japan is often pointed to as an economic nightmare, but this approach of public spending offsetting private deleveraging since their bubble burst almost 20 years ago has kept their economy from going completely down the drain. They've experienced lots of stagnation and strain, but no outright collapse. I'm afraid that's the best we can hope for here over the next several years. But the composition of this package stinks. Tax cuts, even for the middle and lower brackets, are far less stimulative than government spending, especially if that spending includes investments in long-term projects like high-speed rail and green technology. Tax cuts for the very rich are a complete waste. They're going to spend their windfall in hedge fund shares and new Jaguars rather than putting people to work or saving the climate. And the politics stink, too. Given the impending Republican takeover of Congress, this is probably the best the forces of good could do right now, but what a cul-de-sac of failure we're stuck in. Obama never made any effort to trade on this mandate or the Democrats' large majority in Congress. I never expected much out of him, but he's come in well under expectations, as they say on Wall Street. He never made the slightest effort to reconfigure the rhetoric of politics or the public's common sense around economic issues. Unlike Reagan, who forcefully and clearly broke with the Keynesian consensus of the post-World War II decades, Obama never criticized the main principles of economic policy over the last 30 years. When he defends himself against criticism from the left, such as it is, Obama likes to say that public opinion isn't there. But as the great cultural theorist Stuart Hall put it in one of his essays on Thatcherism, politics does not reflect majorities, it constructs them. Thatcherism and Reaganism were all about creating new majorities and popularizing fresh ways of thought. There's never been even a hint of that sort of thing coming out of the White House, and now it's too late. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk celebrity. That was some of Lust in the Movies by the Long Blondes, featuring a lyrical cameo by Edie Sedgwick, who also makes an appearance in the following interview. That interview is with Elizabeth Currid Halkett, author of Starstruck, The Business of Celebrity, just out from Faber and Faber. I think that T.S. Eliot used to work for that publishing house. Currid Halkett is also the author of The Warhol Economy, a treatise on the role of the arts and entertainment in urban economies. She teaches at USC. I must say that this isn't the book I would write, but not everyone I interview has to have my point of view. Elizabeth Currid Halkett. Welcome, Elizabeth. Let's start out with a definition. Just what is a celebrity?
Well, a celebrity is someone who has managed to cultivate a collective public fascination with their person. And it is different from fame, and it is, of course, different from talent. I guess my point here is that you can actually be a celebrity without being famous to the world at large, and you can be famous without being a celebrity. People can know who you are but not care about how you drink your coffee, and most of the world cannot know who you are, but on your Facebook page, people are interested in your every move.
Yeah, you start the book with a kind of Facebook celebrity who you became enchanted with just because of his status update, somebody you'd casually met. This whole new phenomenon of the internet celebrity. Yours is your initial example is very local, but let's talk about the local celebrity who can be just a part of a small circle geographically or socially.
Well, one of the things that was so interesting to me when I started out doing this work, because of my earlier work on art and culture, this was a story about Hollywood and about art stars and famous fashion designers. That was the initial work, because what I was fascinated with was the fact that these particular people were anointed in these industries. And I wasn't sure if they were fundamentally better than everyone else, but they were certainly being handpicked as the people to follow. But when I started looking at this and this phenomenon of celebrity, I realized that it really was about our collective fascination, and that, in fact, that existed everywhere. And so social media like Facebook and Twitter give us a very clear way to see this in all of our lives. But the homecoming queen has always existed, as has the small-town football player. And these people in their worlds are celebrities in the same way that Angelina Jolie is to the world at large.
But, of course, many, many more people know who Angelina Jolie is and care about her.
Of course. Well, that is a result of the industry that she is in. And there's also a question of scale. So one thing that I think is similar is that both M, the Facebook star in my world, and Angelina Jolie have conduits in which they distribute information about themselves. So, you know, Jolie is Vanity Fair. She's Us Weekly. She's reported on Gawker. And M doesn't have access to that. But he does have Facebook and 3,000, 4,000 friends, and that's how he distributes that information. And so the mechanisms are the same, even if the scale is very different.
Now, Angelina Jolie, though, is certainly one of the most beautiful humans on the planet, and I'm not quite sure that she's a great acting talent. But precisely, what is the nature of her fame? How did it come about? How did her celebrity come about?
Well, you're right. She's really beautiful. But so are a lot of people in Hollywood. I mean, that's kind of your ticket to the lottery. I mean, it's not a unique quality in Hollywood to be very good-looking. So I think actually the thing about Jolie is that she's got something going on that transcends the fact that she's a good actress and the fact that she's very pretty. She's interesting. I mean, she genuinely is. I mean, she was interesting when she was married to Billy Bob Thornton and she wore the vial of blood around her neck. And she's interesting because despite being able to run around the globe looking glamorous and picking up an award at the Oscars, that she's also a goodwill ambassador and she travels to developing countries and she cares about humanitarian issues. So she has this whole persona that it makes her rare in her world, and that is, I believe, why she's become, her celebrity has become much bigger than even her fame or her talent. She's simply fascinating to us as a society.
The early manifestation of Angelina, she was sort of a kind of a strange and kinky figure, which is what I think evoked the early interest. Then she's become the humanitarian and serial adopter. Is this a contrivance? Is this something she invented? Or does it emerge out of the inner essence of her personality? Or does that even matter?
I think it doesn't even matter. I think we don't have the answer to that. Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are, I think, some of the most fascinating celebrities because it is not obvious what's going on here. In the way that, say, with Heidi Montag and Spencer Pratt, it's very clear that they are a machine, as is Paris Hilton. I mean, these are people who, they spend their days drumming up publicity. They want us to pay attention. You know, Jolie and Pitt have this sort of insouciance. We can't quite figure out if they have artfully constructed their celebrity or if they just happen to be really interesting people. So that, I think that is very hard, but I think you're right. I think the end game is the same. If we're paying attention, that's all that matters.
You mentioned Paris Hilton, and she, well, let's see, is this an innovation that somebody can be famous for not having any particular talent? Hilton What does she do except go to parties and do scandalous things and look glamorous, but in a kind of salacious way? Is this Paris Hilton kind of celebrity a historical novelty? Are there precedents for Paris Hilton, or is this some innovation of recent time?
I think there are some precedents, but I think the number of Paris-like celebrities have increased rapidly. So I think, if you think about someone like Edie Sedgwick, who was Andy Warhol's muse, I mean, she was a beautiful, interesting, you know, unfortunately, drug-addicted socialite. But she cultivated this kind of, she was a Warhol superstar, and we were interested in her. And she didn't clearly exhibit some sort of fundamental talent, besides capturing Warhol's attention, which I suppose is a somewhat of a talent. But in that sense, she was this sort of socialite who was running out into parties and getting her picture taken. But I do think that the rise of the 24/7 news cycle and the need for information about stars and our ability to document every aspect of their lives has meant that, since that's the currency in which the currency of celebrity, that means that people like Paris exist more, because we don't even care if she has talent. And in fact, in celebrity world, that's not what it's about anyway. So loads of people who have very little talent, you know, suddenly really have a chance to become celebrities. And of course, the deluge of media and the demand for information means that there's just more, there's more outlets for them to be covered too.
Edie Sedgwick is interesting because I think it was Gene Stein and George Plimpton did an oral history of Edie, called Edie, and you know, lots and lots of people talked about how they remembered Edie Sedgwick. Could you imagine doing something like that for Paris Hilton? Could all these people make a book about their memories of Paris Hilton, or is this the media environment so different that we couldn't even imagine somebody doing Paris 10 years from now?
I think we would. I think there's a sort of cultural love to hate Paris, but she is so fascinating because she's the ultimate celebrity. And I think when she stops being a celebrity, because celebrity is inherently ephemeral, we will look back and we will say she was the face of the 2000 zeitgeist. She represented a moment in time. She was able to cultivate a following, which, whether they liked her or didn't like her, paid attention to her. And she was able to do this without having a unique talent. And there's something, she is a leitmotif of society. I really do think. I think she tells us something about ourselves.
What's interesting, also the parallel with Edie, they both came out of rich families. Edie more aristocratic than Paris's more nouveau money. But does that confer any advantage in becoming that kind of celebrity?
There's no question that the barriers to entry are lower if you have money and privilege. I mean, you just get invited to these places more likely. You likely have a more elite social network. You know people, so you end up there. But there's plenty of socialites who have not captured our attention like Paris have. Some of them have not wanted to, and some of them have, and they've still not done that. I mean, the thing that makes Paris so interesting, and again, this is related to Jolie, is that she did something different. She wasn't this, you know, celebrity in a twin set. I mean, socialite in a twin set, like, you know, looking the way she ought to. I mean, she was dancing on tabletops. She was a party animal. I mean, she did things that were so antithetical to our vision of what a high society socialite ought to be doing. And then the media picked up on it. I mean, that's another part for these kind of mainstream celebrities, is that, of course, the media have to want to take your picture. They have to want to write about you. And indeed, they did.
And the contrast with another socialite who's tried very hard but hasn't succeeded the way Paris is, someone who I was fascinated by a couple of years ago, is Tinsley Mortimer. What does Paris have that Tinsley lacks?
Well, this is the sort of the sort of million-dollar question about celebrity, is that you measure it in terms of our reaction to people rather than what they have, because that is still quite mysterious. I would speculate that Paris is a genuinely more interesting person, for better and for worse. I mean, she's more deviant. She misbehaves more. She gets in trouble. I mean, Tinsley doesn't do that much that would make it worth talking about. I mean, she goes to events and she gets a picture taken and she looks good in dresses. But that's not the same thing. That only holds our attention for so long.
I was stunned to learn in the book that Paris actually pees on the floor.
Yeah, that's what Richard Johnson from, formerly from Page Six, told me. I was shocked too.
That is remarkable, but that is like almost the watchword for misbehaving.
I can you ever imagine Tinsley Mortimer doing that or any other socialite? I mean, no way.
No, but Paris also has a gift for the soundbite, doesn't she?
She does. She is a lot more intelligent than we give her credit for. She really does seem to know what she's doing.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Currid Helkert, who is the author of Starstruck, The Business of Celebrity. You have an interesting contrast. Well, you do some network analysis of celebrity. It's very interesting to see how the A, the B, and the C lists are differentiated from each other. So how did the A-listers behave differently from the C-listers?
Well, the thing that A-listers do is they tend to go to less events but more prestigious ones. So they get a lot more bang for their buck with their socializing. So you could look at all of the people my colleague Gilad Ravid and I studied. So we basically took 600,000 photographs taken by Getty Images, and we looked at the caption information. And we looked at where these photographs were taken, who else was in the photographs, how many photographs were taken of the events, you know, when even during the year these photographs were taken. And we did find that even though the entire network is clearly very elite, that there is this special group of people, this A-list, that tend to only socialize with each other and at the sort of best, most prestigious events. And, you know, in some ways you could say, well, if you win an Oscar, you get into the A-list. And there's a truth to that. But the other thing is that they do seem to make decisions about what events they go to and how many times they go to events and where those events are located in a way that other stars don't. I mean, for example, I don't think there might be like one A-lister who shows up at events in Las Vegas. I mean, this is not something that people like Tom Cruise or George Clooney do. Or certainly they don't get photographed doing it.
Yeah, there's a real geography to celebrity, right? It just happens in a few places.
It really does. I mean, in the most basic no-da way, it's like where you've got to go to L.A. or New York or London because people need to take your picture, and that is what we need as society or as a public to form a connection to these people. But there is something more nuanced at play, which is that the people who are, you know, bona fide A-listers, they tend to go to events in Tokyo and Amsterdam and Sydney, and they tend to be in more exotic locales than just the obvious, you know, places to show up. And that looks a lot different from stars who essentially attain their celebrity through the media.
And now I can feel the ghost of Neil Postman over my shoulder saying, we're amusing ourselves to death. We spend so much time obsessing about Angelina and Paris that we don't think about the economic crisis, what we still haven't gotten out of, cholera in Haiti, climate change, you know, any number of things that are of extraordinary consequence that we just don't want to think about. Is celebrity crowding that out of our consciousness?
You know, I this is a question I think about a lot. I'm not sure what the right answer is. On the one hand, you know, I'm a populist. I look around and I say, if this is what we're paying attention to, then it must be important. I mean, you can measure if we are giving something our attention and our time, then it's telling us something about what we value and what we care about, at least in this moment of in time. On the other hand, I am concerned that we may indulge ourselves too much, that we, before we pick up the tabloid, we ought to know what's going on in the world around us. And that isn't something that I think we always do. I think it's just easier to find out, you know, where Jen Aniston had dinner last night than to find out what's going on in Darfur or what's going on with the financial crisis. It's just easier and it's more fun, but I don't think that's necessarily the right thing to do every time.
We also cite some stuff about the breakdown of social ties and a spread of a narcissistic kind of personality, which is actually, funnily enough, the Psychiatric Association is thinking of dropping the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder at the very time it seems to be permeating the whole society. What is the relation between narcissism and celebrity?
Well, I think there's certainly been research done that has said that celebrities are more likely to be narcissists than the general population. But there's no question that, I mean, I think it would be a terrible generalization to say all celebrities are narcissists. That's just not true. But there is something going on in our society that is not just in Hollywood, but in fact on our Facebook profiles and in Twitter and on blogs, where we have become self-obsessed and we have become motivated to overshare because that's our way of getting attention from people. And you're right, there's no way that if you're spending all of your time updating your Facebook update with what you had for breakfast, that you have a chance to read the newspaper and know what else is going on. So I think that there is definitely an uptick in the, certainly the symptoms of narcissism in society. And this this has actually been studied by people, not just me, that they've noticed this rise in narcissism just everywhere in society.
And also channeling the social critic. I think there are a lot of people who would say that this fascination with celebrity is totally manipulated by the culture industry, by the whole network of publicists and the media machinery, and that people are just passive recipients of this manipulation. What do you say to that?
I don't agree. I think that the public, there's no question that the public needs to make a choice based on what's on offer, but we could pick up the New York Times and we can watch the BBC and we can pick up Us Weekly, and so we're making choices as a society to pay a lot of attention to these people. And you know, the media sometimes gloms onto people that we don't glom onto, and sometimes we glom onto people and the media feels that they need to pay more attention to those people. So the public has a role in this. I mean, even if they can't, you know, they're not the masterminds where they pick the someone out of nowhere. I mean, I think actually, you know, particularly with the advent of reality TV, we have much more agency in selecting our stars.
But of course, these people are produced. I mean, somebody like you mentioned that Jennifer Aniston, for example, spent $50,000 one week on her hair. And the whole thing about Jennifer Aniston's hair is it's supposed to look so fresh and natural. It's created, right? How did she spend $50,000 in one week on her hair?
Well, if I remember correctly, she flew her stylist over. She put him up in hotels, and she he charged an exorbitant amount for his haircut. So I think all in all, she just wasn't going to get a cut from you know, a hairstylist in London. She was going to bring her guy over and fly him first class and put him in a 5-star hotel, and then God only knows what he charges for the day. I think I actually do have the details of that somewhere in the book, but it's an amazing amount of money. But you know, the thing about that that's kind of fascinating is that celebrity's big business. I mean, it really is. I mean, this is actually a lot of money, and that is exchanging hands, and that there are a lot of people involved in the production of celebrity. So from an economic perspective, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, people have jobs because we're obsessed with certain stars.
You actually do talk a bit about Bollywood, the Indian movie celebrity machine, which is completely different, right? There's not anywhere near the professionalization that we see in the U.S.
You're right. I mean, Bollywood is fascinating because it is a much more personal network, and they are not, they don't have like the same amount. They have, you know, tremendous tabloids, but they don't have the same kind of, you know, agents, publicists sort of network that we see in Hollywood.
And finally, what about, you know, the economic cycle? To what degree is celebrity a byproduct of an economic bubble? And how has it fared during this crisis and recession? Are people more interested in celebrity as an escape, or is it just so much froth that disappears when the times get hard?
Well, I mean, we're in a pretty tough time right now, and I haven't seen it go away. So I think maybe we want different things from our stars. People like Paris, maybe they seem too excessive. That said, I mean, the rise of reality TV and excessive behavior has not. You know, in any way decreased, and nor has our interest in it decreased. So I think, initially maybe we sort of celebrated these people, and now they become sort of outlets and of distraction, so we don't have to think about big issues. But I don't see it going away at all.
So celebrity has some legs.
It sure does. And I think also the reason that is that it has always existed. I mean, I really think that technology and our ability to have this sort of information every 2 minutes, you know, about whoever we want to, makes it seem like it's like a new phenomenon. But I actually believe that if you look through time, that we've always been obsessed with particular people. for reasons that are somewhat unexplainable and have nothing to do with their contributions to the world.
Just some people are more interesting than others.
Yeah.
That was Elizabeth Currid-Halkett, author of Starstruck, The Business of Celebrity, just out from Faber and Faber. She also teaches at USC. Just to put the economic impact of celebrity into perspective, Currid-Halkett estimates that just over 100,000 jobs in New York and L.A. are dependent on the celebrity business. While that's well above zero, it's still equal to only about 2% of employment in each of the two metro areas. Given that one job usually helps create another half a job, all those publicists and handlers buy lots of lunches and clothes after all, we're still talking about just over 3% of employment. Again, above zero, but not all that big a deal. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk economic lies. That was a bit of Karlheinz Stockhausen's Kontakte, from the 13th structure, to be precise, from 1960. It's amazing how long ago a lot of that classic avant-garde stuff was written. But of course, without it, there'd be no LCD sound system. My next guest is Joshua Holland, who's a writer and editor with Alternet. His book, The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy, is just out from Wiley. Since this is the holiday season, this might be the perfect book to prepare for arguments with your reactionary sister-in-law over family dinners, or arguments with a reactionary loudmouth at your local saloon, or just for understanding how half the economic commentary you read is utter nonsense. Joshua Holland. Welcome, Joshua. The news is cooperating very nicely with this interview. It looks like the president and the Republican leadership have come to a deal on extending the tax cuts. How many lies are contained behind that deal?
Well, a number of lies are within. In terms of tax policy in general, conservative rhetoric on taxes and spending is wildly inaccurate. I don't think that the deal is a done deal. We're seeing filibuster threats from both left and right. Senator Jim DeMint has said that he would filibuster, as has Bernie Sanders. But assuming it goes through, I think that it is another indication of the Obama administration's problems of driving a hard bargain. They projected that they would cave on the upper income tax cuts weeks and weeks and weeks ago. You could have seen the writing on the wall if you were looking. And having said that, I don't think it's all bad. There are things in there that are good for progressives, but again, we see this inability to inflict political damage on the Republicans for causing real economic pain on Main Street. President Obama talked about hostage taking. This is a very apt metaphor, I think, because they really did, you know, we're talking about letting, not extending unemployment benefits at a time with 9.8% unemployment, 17% unemployment and underemployment, and that is incredible. We're talking about real pain for real working families where their benefits are running out. And one would think that a competent political party could inflict great damage on an opponent who insisted on tax cuts for the wealthiest people in order to help those who have been hurt most by the economic downturn.
Yeah, I was just reading an old 20-year-old plus essay by Stuart Hall in which he says, politics doesn't reflect majorities, it constructs them. And it seems that the Obama administration has made no effort to push back in a rhetorical sense to challenge the kinds of lies that you read about in your book. They're really not challenging, for example, the centrality of tax cuts. They're really not trying to change the economic narrative very much, are they?
I agree. And this is the great disappointment that I've had with the administration. I don't think that my hopes were as high as many others in terms of the kind of sweeping changes that they could have accomplished, just given the kind of structural situation. I mean, you know, we do have this anti-democratic system in the Senate. You need 60 votes to do everything. It seems today that you can't, you know, name a post office after a war hero without 60 votes. The hope that I had had was that this was a great communicator who could, over the long term, shift some of the economic discourse back to the center. And one of the central kind of narratives in my book is how far to the right it has shifted in the last, say, 35 years.
But yeah, let's talk about taxes and economic growth. This is one of the lies you write about. The Republicans, the right, believe that all you need to do to foster economic growth is cut taxes and get government out of the way, and things will just kind of take off. Is there any evidence for this?
You know, there is evidence that if you have gross overtaxation and you cut it down, that you can unleash economic activity. The example often given, and I've been told this by a million conservatives, is that, you know, JFK cut taxes. Well, he cut taxes when they were at 90, the top marginal rate was at 91%. The kernel of truth is that tax policy does influence behavior. And depending on what tax you're talking about and what it's set at when you cut it or raise it, you can certainly affect economic actors' behaviors. But this idea that cutting taxes unleashes growth has absolutely no basis in reality as a broad principle. One of the things that I talk about in the book is this kind of brazen lie, and I've heard this in the last week, that every single time taxes are cut, revenues increase. This is something that Republicans and conservatives, pretty much wherever you find them, seem to agree on, except for, you know, academics. And in the book, I quote a number of conservative academics and members of Bush's economic team, people who are, unlike Rush Limbaugh, who have to face their peers, and all of them agree that, you know, with the basic mathematical principle that cutting taxes has as a primary effect cutting revenues.
But you almost think it's a matter of self-interest rather than...
you might, huh? I mean, amazing how that works out. And, you know, the funny thing is that if you look at some of the kind of bedrock narratives that are embraced by pretty much everybody, think about out-of-control government spending. If you look at the average between 2004 and 2007, government spending as a share of GDP, we ranked 25th out of 28 countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. That's the Wealthy Countries Club. We were way at the bottom. We have a very, very limited government. When we talk about a deficit problem, it's hard for me to understand how we can have a deficit problem when we're not spending a great deal relative to our wealth. If you look at our tax burden, in 2008, we ranked, I believe it was 28th out of 30 countries in the OECD. So this idea that there's a structural economic problem called deficit is, for me, a great fallacy, and yet it's embraced almost universally. If you think about it, I believe it's an ideological choice to look at the fiscal picture as a structural economic problem. You can just as easily look at it as I write today on alternet.org, you can just as easily look at it as a unsustainable military defense budget problem. And as economist Dean Baker points out, if we were to spend the same on healthcare per capita as the countries that have longer average life expectancies than the United States, our projected deficit problems would vanish instantly and we'd be looking at surpluses.
You also write that the Republicans really are not the party of fiscal probity. You know, we hear constantly about how the Democrats are spending us into oblivion and the Republicans are the party of fiscal responsibility, but that's not really true, is it?
I think it's almost a testament to their message machine. The idea that these are fiscally responsible people is really, again, not grounded in any sort of reality. If you look over, say, since the Eisenhower administration, the share of GDP spent on government has moved up and down in a very, very narrow range. On the federal side, between, say, 18 and 21% of GDP. And this is regardless of who is in Congress, who controls Congress, who's in the White House. The same on the spending side. But the differences are when Republican presidents come in, spending increases a little bit more than when Democratic presidents come in, and revenues go down a little bit. And if you look at that gap between revenues and spending, in a huge economy such as ours, a $14, $15 trillion economy, that half point on either side creates huge deficits. So yes, as far as I can see in the evidence and the data, conservatives are the folks who spend and run up deficits. And yet a broad swath of the American public, including a lot of, I think, elected politicians, have internalized the narrative that the opposite is true.
I notice you quote, as an epigraph of one of your chapters, a right-wing nut I was at a TV debate with a couple of weeks ago, Peter Schiff, who in that remarkable shout-fest claimed that unemployment insurance is too generous, so if we just cut unemployment insurance, people would go back to work. Also, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis gave a speech recently where he said the problem with unemployment is not economic, it's just that we don't have the right kind of workers for their jobs. This is sort of a structural unemployment situation that the Fed can't really do anything about, policy can't really do much about. They just have the wrong workforce for the modern kinds of jobs we need. Are there really lots of jobs out there going begging?
You know, there are not lots of jobs out there going begging, but there have been situations where employers have, this is called anecdata. The New York Times ran a piece, I think the Wall Street Journal had a piece as well, where they talked to a few business owners who were having trouble filling positions, and then that from those anecdotal experiences, a kind of larger narrative has been portrayed. The danger, I think, in terms of, I don't believe that the unemployment rate is structural by any means. The danger is that when you look at the length of unemployment right now, we have a record number of people who've been unemployed for 25 weeks or longer. There is the potential that a lot of those people, when they're out of jobs that long, will have trouble reentering the workforce, and then it becomes structural. To your first point, this is a classic lie about unemployment benefits. And it's the idea is that we don't really, you know, as human beings, we don't really want to be active. We just want to sit and watch Oprah. And if we get unemployment checks of $350 a week, we will do that instead of going out and finding a job. There is absolutely no data to support this. The kernel of truth to this, what I say is a lie, is that research has shown that if you have very generous unemployment benefits, some European countries have this, and you don't have time limits on those unemployment benefits, you will add to the long-term unemployed, because then a rational actor might indeed choose a more leisurely life on the public dime. There is absolutely no evidence. We have incredibly stingy unemployment benefits in terms of replacement of lost income, and I've seen absolutely no studies that suggest that those kinds of benefits with time limits encourages people to stay out of the labor force.
I was speaking with Joshua Holland, who is the author of the 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy, just out from Wiley. Another common myth, it's almost really foundational in American culture, the American mind, is that we are a country of upward mobility, great fluidity, and all the fluidity seems to flow uphill. Just how upwardly mobile are we now?
You know, this is, it's a very, I think that it's key that you point out it's a foundational myth. It justifies our threadbare social safety net. So this is a part of a larger narrative that we live in a perfect meritocracy, and that is on the individual to persevere and raise themselves by the bootstraps. The reality is that is much harder today in the United States than it is in a number of different Western countries, advanced economies. And there's a number of reasons for this, but I would point to a few. There is the decline in unionism, trade unionism, which used to give an opportunity for ladders up into the middle class for people without college educations. And then a lot of issues with our education system, which is a very complex topic for another show probably. But these things have made the United States economy less upwardly mobile than the economies of, say, France and Canada and Germany and a number of other states, which I cite in the book. And I think that it is important to understand. Another thing that's very interesting is there's opinion polls that have asked people periodically over the years to define the American dream. And with the economic crash of 2007 and 2008, there's been a largely unremarked upon shift where people really don't see the American dream as going from a working class background to a middle class reality where you have a home and a car and you can send your kids to college. Right now, the focus on the quote-unquote American dream is all about economic security, and that really speaks to the 35, 40-year assault on working America's economic security.
And you mentioned education. It seems that education now is reinforcing social divisions more than it's undermining them.
You know, the testing fetish there's a lot of data to suggest that privileges kids who have a privileged background. The other thing is that you have a system here where we spend an enormous amount on our kids, on educating our kids compared to a lot of other countries, but we don't do it consistently where, different school districts have the access to the same kind of resources. So this creates a two or more tiered education system where the community where you're raised in has a lot of influence on the kind of school that you attend.
And a couple more myths that have great currency right now. One is that poor people caused the housing crisis because liberals made the banks lend to people who couldn't afford to pay their mortgages, and the banks were just innocent victims of misguided social policy.
Yeah, it's as pernicious as it is pervasive, I would say. The basic conservative story is that through the Community Reinvestment Act and through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are private companies until the government took them over, but which had a public mandate as well, were basically forcing banks to lend money to people who weren't qualified. And to that, I would say you should read Poor People and People of Color. The reality is that the Community Reinvestment Act is an incredibly thin measure meant not to mandate anything. It has absolutely zero mandate. It encourages banks to lend in the areas where they have branches. And this was meant to mitigate the problem of redlining, so-called redlining in lending. There are no penalties for not complying with CRA, except for the only thing that results from non-compliance is that it can be taken into consideration when a bank applies for a merger to open new branches. The reality in the banking sector is that this is not a hurdle that needs to be jumped. It's incredibly easy to do so. The other thing is that CRA explicitly states in the law that all these loans must be issued with sound lending standards in mind. The reality of what happened, of course, is that through deregulation, the link between the lender and the borrower was broken because they were able to this so-called securitization process where they cut up mortgages into these investment vehicles and sold them off to investors. And this was a means of basically laundering the risk out of high-risk loans. And once they had laundered the risk out of high-risk loans and did not face exposure for the consequences of irresponsible lending, they saw this incredibly fat revenue stream, and they had an insatiable hunger for new mortgages to wrap up into these investment vehicles. And they encouraged the loan originators to lower their standards, and they basically paid off the ratings agencies to bless their products as AAA rated so that pension funds and whatnot could buy into them. That's the reality of what caused the mortgage crisis. And to blame it on poor people and liberal social policy is very attractive to conservatives and completely false.
Another kind of blame the week meme that's very popular lately is that immigrants are driving down our wages and stealing our jobs, and if we just close the borders, things will improve. How true is that?
Well, you know, there is very little evidence that there's any significant effect on native wages or opportunities from immigration. I think that it's fueled primarily by a kind of myth that defies common sense, and that is that when immigrants join the labor force, they provide labor, but they don't create demand for additional labor. So the laws of supply and demand would dictate that that lowers wages. But the reality is that when a college grad enters the workforce, they're not lowering other people's wages because they're going to need to have housing and clothes and food and healthcare and all the other things that we spend money on. And those goods and services are going to require workers to provide. So a working person provides labor, supplies labor, and they also create demand for labor. And this is, I think common sense would indicate that. And it's interesting to me that so many people have kind of fallen for this idea that foreign workers drive down wages. Now, there is, again, some controversy, a kernel of truth that may or may not be right, which is that some studies have found that migrant workers do affect the wages of like high school dropouts, low-income workers. But other studies have found the reverse to be true. And if you look at a review of all the economic data, you'll see that there's just very little solid evidence to back up the claims made by many conservatives who oppose immigration. Now, the other side of that is that it's not just wages and opportunities. There's also the drain on social services, the supposed drain on social services. And this is created by using education and assuming that education is a sunk cost. Because when you really dig into the data, what you see is that first-generation immigrants do take more in services than they pay in taxes, in large part because their children attend school. But education is not a sunk cost. It's an investment. And if you look at the first and second generation of immigrants, including low education immigrants who don't have high income, what you see is that they pay in much more in taxes than they take in services.
And then finally, Republicans love to say that environmental regulation is going to destroy jobs. And if we can't afford to take any action on climate change now because it would be the end of prosperity as we know it. What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly common trope. There's a couple of problems with it. First of all, is that the thing that I think that whole narrative ignores is the idea of negative externalities. If you pollute my air and water, that imposes a cost on me that's not included in your transaction, in your private sector transaction. And what regulation does is prevents that from happening. It internalizes external costs, it's a really key economic principle. It's a bedrock economic principle, in fact. The other side of that, of course, is that the United States is falling behind a lot of countries in terms of the inevitable transition that we must all make to a so-called greener economy. And that's in large part because, so this doesn't get directly to regulation, but it's about environmental policy, in large part because we are much less enthusiastic about investing public funds in innovative technologies. You see, the Chinese are rushing ahead of us, for example, in wind, solar, and high-speed rail, a lot of key parts of this future greener economy.
That was Joshua Holland, who's a writer and editor at Alternet. His book, The 15 Biggest Lies About the Economy, is just out from Wiley. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with some of that spawn of Stockhausen I mentioned earlier. This is a bit of the XFM mix of LCD sound systems on repeat. Till next week, bye.
It's about the slow repeat beats of all beef. street.